This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Bette Davis was a child of the 60s, you know, an anti-war, anti-nuclear activist who hung out with rock stars, married a yoga instructor, and supported a woman's right to an abortion. Davis was also a child of Ronald and Nancy Reagan, and her leftist political views took on an added meaning. This rift in the Reagan family was well known, but in the mid-80s, with her father still in the White House, Davis became even more outspoken. She began writing novels. The first, Homefront, has a plot that may sound familiar. The central character, Beth Canfield, undergoes a personal crisis when her leftist political views become an issue in her conservative father's campaign for the presidency. Davis' second novel, A House of Secrets, tells the story of a young woman whose mother compulsively and violently tries to control every aspect of her life. Davis has now come out from behind her thin veil of fiction and written a memoir called The Way I See It. Terry Gross spoke with Bette Davis last week.
Now, you write that you've learned forgiveness and gotten over some of your anger.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you write the book?
Well, to say that, basically, and to say that whatever somebody's experiences were in their childhood, there is a way of looking at them differently. And there is a way of coming to the realization that your parents did the best they knew how. I don't think this is information that we should sit on. If any of us come to this point, do the work in our lives to come to this point, I think we have a responsibility to share it with each other in whatever way is appropriate to our lives, and writing a book is appropriate to mine. I'm a public person and I'm a writer.
How did it make you feel to think that your family, which you think of as a dysfunctional family, was the first family in the pro-family White House?
You know, actually, I thought it was kind of appropriate in a way, because we're dysfunctional as a country. I mean, first of all, I think most families are dysfunctional to one degree or another. That's the work that we have to do as human beings on this planet. But we're a dysfunctional country. It's not surprising. And I think that we have to feel entitled to talk about that and deal with it and accept that about ourselves in order to change that about ourselves.
Well, one of the issues that you bring up in your memoir is that you felt that you felt that your parents' relationship with each other cut you off, that they were so involved with each other that there wasn't much room for you.
Well, that's true. It wasn't just me. I think it's anybody, really. We sort of saw that in this country, didn't we? I mean, their love is, I think I described it in the book, as being sort of two halves of a circle. And together they form this complete whole, and everybody else seems sort of superfluous to that. And certainly as a child growing up in that environment, I was aware of that, as were all their children.
What's an example of how you felt that there was no room for you?
Well, I think probably one of the most telling examples is a story I tell in the book about flying back after my father was shot. And it was Michael and Maureen and me on this army transport plane, and I had this awareness that we were all conscious of the fact that we weren't really needed there. My parents needed each other. I mean, we were going back there when we wanted to be there, but we weren't really needed.
How long did you stay?
I stayed a few days, I think.
Did you feel differently once you got there?
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't particularly feel different about that. But I did. I had an experience with my mother the morning after the morning that I arrived. I arrived like before dawn or something like that. And I went into her bedroom, and she told me that my father had almost died, and she told me that she had taken one of his shirts and had slept with it all night. And I was sitting on the bed, and it was the first time that I felt what forgiving her would feel like, because in that moment we were not a mother and daughter who had been at each other for years. We were just two people who had realized in a very short period of time how frightening life can get. And it was a very exquisite moment, which is why I sort of flash-forwarded and I began the book with that.
Mm-hmm. You write in your memoir, as uncomfortable as it is to talk about and write about, abuse is part of this story.
Mm-hmm.
How did your mother abuse you?
Physically, in terms of hitting me in the face, and emotionally, I think in ways of humiliation and making me feel that I could never measure up. But you know, I see it now as two people being abused there, because she was abusing herself too by doing that to me. I mean, our children are extensions of ourselves, and what we do to them, we on some level do to ourselves.
When you say she'd hit you in the face, was that when you were misbehaving?
Oh, sometimes, and it almost became a ritual between us. It almost became this very predictable thing. It became a daily event after a while. But again, you know, you have to call it what it is, and it's abuse. And this is not a book about comparing war wounds. I don't tell these stories in a context of saying, let me tell you how horrible this was. You know, I'm not there anymore with a measuring stick on my childhood and saying, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how horrible is this? I don't think like that anymore. I did for a long time. What happened, happened, and you have to call it what it is. But also what was happening was something under the surface that on one level had nothing to do with me. These cycles started before I was born. They went back generations. I mean, I was a victim. My parents were victims, and my parents were victims of victims and on back. And I think that's where forgiveness comes in.
Are you on speaking terms with your parents now? I know there have been times when you haven't been.
I'm not now. I haven't. We haven't spoken in quite a while.
Years, Mom?
The last time I saw my mother was in 1989. The last time I saw my father was in last year, as I was writing this book, and I went to see him. I wrote about that, a visit in his office, where I went to say to him, my purpose in writing this book is because I believe that the right way to live is just to tell the truth. Whatever that truth is, just tell it. It's okay. I'm not doing this to inflict pain. I knew he wouldn't hear that, and I knew he wouldn't accept that, but I felt that it was important to say it.
Yeah, here's what I wonder about that. I mean, I believe in telling the truth, but I also believe, you know, that you don't necessarily tell everything. I mean, you don't lie, but on the other hand, I mean, I don't tell everything I know about my parents or the people who are closest to me in my life. Do you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Just for reasons of privacy.
Well, I mean, there are certain things I didn't tell in this book, things that I didn't think were relevant. But the bigger issues and the stories that I chose that had a particular point to them,
yeah,
the point that I was trying to make, I felt were important to tell. Because, you know, to the degree that any of us feel that we have to hide, then we get caught up in feeling guilty and feeling ashamed. And that's a harsh way to live. And I know, because I lived like that for a long time.
So how come you haven't spoken to your mother since 89 and to your father since, I forget how long it was that you just
last
said.
Year.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what this family is going to end up being. I don't even know what's supposed to happen. I do know that I couldn't have come to a place of releasing them from blame and I couldn't have come to a place of forgiving them without pulling back and staying away. I needed that vantage point in order to change my perspective. And I think it would be wonderful to be able to stand in front of my parents and say to them, you know, I forgive you and I release you and all that. It's always a loaded situation, though, because any one of a number of things can come back at you, including, well, that's fine, you forgive us, but we don't necessarily forgive you, and then you have to forgive them for not forgiving you. That takes growth. I'm not sure I'm there yet, actually. Mm-hmm. I think there's still some fear there on my part. I think that coming to terms with your parental issues is internal work. You have to get clear about it within yourself. And then if something changes externally, great.
The last time you spoke to your mother was in 1989. That's the same year that her memoir, My Turn, was published.
Yes.
Are the two related?
No, I saw her before that, actually, before that book came out. I have not seen her after that.
But, I mean, was the book one of the reasons why you haven't been speaking with her?
Oh, no, no, no. Nothing in her books surprised me. I mean, I know there was a lot of attention on the 10 pages that she wrote about me and complaining about my infancy and all that. But nothing really surprised me.
Let me quote a couple of things that she says about you and get your side of it.
Okay.
She says, I've had my ups and downs with all four children, but my relationship with Patty has been one of the most painful and disappointing aspects of my life. I was a nervous mother, and Patty was a difficult baby from the start. She'd scream for hours. And then Nancy Reagan goes on to say that she thinks that she and Ronald Reagan were too indulgent and gave in to you too often. They paid you too much attention.
Well, I think that my response is to that is that that's what she needs to believe. And that's okay. I understand that. That's, you know, we are talking about a family that has an enormous capacity for denial. And you just read part of it. And it's okay, you know. It's all right with me that she feels that way because that's what she needs to think. It's not my perspective on what happened, but it's all right.
Your mother was pregnant with you 2 months before she married your father.
Yes.
When did you find out about that?
Well, I figured it out one day when I was, I don't know, maybe I was 9 or 10, something like that. And I was snooping around through her desk drawers, and I found one of those little baby books that they give women, you know,
mm-hmm.
With all the, you know, birth records and all that stuff. And I found my birth weight, which was almost 8 pounds. It's rather large, preemie. So I figured out that I probably wasn't premature, and I had been told that I'd been kept in an incubator and all of that stuff, and I was pretty sure they didn't make incubators that big. And but my mother never really admitted it. My mother never admitted it until she wrote her own book, and then she still didn't really admit it. I mean, she was a bit coy about it.
So did you kind of confronted your mother with this, didn't you?
Well, I don't know if I can't remember confronting her with that. You know, the other story that I had been handed about my birth was that I had hung on to her ribs. And this was a story my parents gave me for years. And I think around that same time I was taking science class or something. And remember those color plates in the science books of the bodies that are cut in, had drawings of the bodies, you know, mm-hmm. they're cut in half. So the female color plate. I thought, well, now here's the uterus. The baby's in the uterus. I sort of mapped it out, you know, what I would have had to do to hang onto her ribs, which basically meant punching through the uterus, snaking up through the intestines and shoving a few organs out of the way and grabbing onto her ribs. And so I came back with this book and I said, look, see, I couldn't have done this. And she said, well, you did. And you came out with scabs on your fingers. And the story got even more elaborate. So I didn't really confront it after that.
Was this something that you think you were made to feel guilty about when you were growing up, that you caused your mother such pain when you were being born?
I think that was probably part of it, yes. And I think also that my parents felt compelled to lie about my mother being pregnant when she got married because of the morality of the times. And being creative people, they just concocted this story. I think it's on the one hand that sort of simple, and then on the other hand, more complex in terms of instilling guilt in me.
Terry Gross is speaking with Patty Davis, whose new memoir is called The Way I See It. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Patty Davis is my guest, and she's written an autobiography called The Way I See It, which is in part about growing up in the Reagan household. When your father became governor of California, what were you expected to do to help create the family image?
Well, I went to the inauguration, had the photographs taken, you know, at Christmas and all of that. That was basically it. I think that I was not a desirable person to have around in too many of those occasions because I looked as miserable as I felt. And the pictures that are in this book of those occasions sort of bear me out on that. I was not a happy girl in those pictures.
What was the inaugural ball like for you?
Oh, God. It was horrible. It was horrible. They sit you up in this platform, this tiny little platform, and there's this crush of people there that are just standing there staring at you. It was like some Fellini movie. It was the most bizarre experience that I think I've ever been through. I mean, you don't know what to do. You're like just this little animal on exhibit or something. It was very strange.
How did you decide what to wear?
Someone told me what to wear. I was numb at that time. I had somebody had taken me on as a manager, and so he basically told me what to wear. And I was just, you know, I hadn't dealt with the enormity of the fact that my father was going to be president. I have done my time with denial, too. And my form of denial is getting real tough and saying, oh, it's okay, I can take it. This is fine. This is nothing. And I remember a friend saying to me, don't do that. This is big. Just recognize how big this is, you know. You're going to have to deal with this. And I didn't want to. So consequently, around that time, I was just sort of numb. And somebody told me to do something. I went, okay, wear this dress. Okay. It was a very odd time.
Who was your escort, as I think we call it?
Neil Leonard. He was a childhood friend. He'd gone to school with my brother. And he went with me.
How did you choose him? I mean, this must be really difficult. If you're not actually involved in a long-term relationship with someone, it must be a difficult
decision. My mother chose
him. Your mother chose him?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, I mean, why'd you let her choose someone, and why did she choose him?
Well, because I was in that numb phase.
Right.
Whatever, I don't care. And she said, he's going to... was I going to take one of my friends? They'd show up in earrings and black leather. I'm like, come on. I think she chose him because it's like, God knows who Patty would bring to this, you know, some biker or something, you know? So I just went, okay, it's fine.
Your mother's big campaign when the Reagans were in the White House was the Just Say No campaign.
Yes.
But you write that she had a long history of tranquilizers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think of her as an abuser?
Well, I certainly saw a dependence there. And, you know, I agonized a lot over revealing this. But she's gotten a pretty heavy indictment from people who think that her choice of this issue was hypocritical, that she doesn't know anything about it, she doesn't care about it, it was a PR stunt. And then when she abandoned Phoenix House, she got even stiffer indictment. And, I mean, in some ways, she's been made a joke of. Comedians make jokes of her. I kept coming back to the same point, which was that I only ever saw it one way. I saw her choice of that issue as I wrote in this book, both an act of denial and a cry for help. It was the only issue she could have chosen. She cares deeply for this issue, and she understands it more than people think. She has been, in my opinion, a victim of the medical establishment. And I felt, well, if all I can feel about this is compassion and sympathy, then if other people really knew the truth, they would feel the same thing. Because the indictment of hypocrisy has already been handed down. That's a done deal. If anything, this information will undo that and make people say, wow, that's what was going on there. There was a problem there that she was trying to deal with, but then afraid to deal with, and all of that stuff was going on there. That kind of battle was going on within her.
Do you think she still is dependent on tranquilizers?
I don't know, but they are very, very difficult to get off of. I mean, you pretty much have to go for treatment.
So you think she was still dependent when she was in the White House?
Well, I know in 81 she was. I told a story about when my grandfather was dying. Where I saw her get a prescription from his doctor. So I know in 81 she was. You know, I think there's a point here I want to make. I think that if my mother realized that by talking about her own reality and her own situation, people would not condemn her. They would, in fact, flock to her. She could have as much effect on the anti-drug issue as Magic Johnson has had on AIDS awareness. Because the truth of the matter is we're a drug-taking society on every level, from prescription drugs from doctors to over-the-counter medications to street drugs. It permeates the society. And until we realize that about ourselves, we're always going to have a drug problem in this society. And I think that my mother, perhaps more than anyone else, could bring awareness to that and could have a tremendous effect.
We should mention here, you've had problems with drugs yourself.
I was addicted to diet pills for about 5 years.
Was it because of the speed or because of your urge to be thin?
Well, it started out as an urge to be thin. We all give ourselves an excuse. And it was a valid excuse for about a month. But really, I had found my drug. I mean, for about a month until I lost weight. And then it was just, I had found my drug. I didn't get addicted. You know, I did a lot of drugs in the early 70s, but I didn't get addicted to anything else. That was my addiction.
You changed your name to Patty Davis as opposed mm-hmm. to Patty Reagan, taking mm-hmm. your mother's maiden name, so that you wouldn't always be seen as daughter of.
Yeah.
Did it accomplish what you wanted to? I mean, now people are knowing you more and more as daughter of,
right.
'cause that's what you've been writing about.
Right, right. Well, I think symbolically, I was 20-something, 22 or something when I changed it. I think symbolically I wanted my own name. But I see now that taking my mother's maiden name was really that little child in me saying, is this okay? Do you like me now?
Patty Davis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patty Davis' memoir is called The Way I See It. She spoke with Terry Gross. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.